Welcome to our second live podcast taping episode. We made it a little bit longer because we want you to have something to listen to going into the new year, since this is our last episode of 2018. We taped in front of a crowd of about 75 plus leaders at Munkle Brewing Company in Charleston last Thursday. Does it sound like we recorded in a medieval hall? Yes, it does. But it's great. Now, if you missed it, don't worry. We have another live taping coming up in Columbia on January 3rd at White Mule at 6 p.m. So hold on to your butts. It's the year in review. Help me out here, AT.
Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of December 11th, 2018. This week, we're taping live in front of a brewery audience, a completely original concept, so welcome to Charleston! Yes, we are recapping the news and surprises of 2018. From the first congressional district roller coaster, the ongoing VC summer boondoggle, to the governor's race, Lindsey Graham's rebirth, and Nikki Haley's exit, we have you covered tonight. So we got plenty of news to talk about. We're gonna try and cram it in as best as we can. And we got some breaking news, late breaking news here. Hopefully this live crowd won't find it too tacky, but we're gonna have our next live taping in another big city in South Carolina, a little place called Columbia. It's pretty famously hot. So, no, don't disrespect to Charleston, we love being here, but we're going to be in Columbia on Thursday, January 3rd at White Mule at 6 p.m. So it's going to be a hometown show, folks, hashtag the real Southern hotspot. But we know where the real Southern hotspot is because we're here right now. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who are at the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, where's my whip crack, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections instead of wondering if the plastic bags that we brought to Charleston will make us felons now. We brought a few down here. Or instead of wondering if this is Spoleto. Are we at Spoleto? Is this what Spoleto? No? Getting word this is not Spoleto. And with that, it's our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a recap of the top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reported that Charleston, the largest city in South Carolina, has banned plastic bags, straws, and foam containers. There we go. Joining 10 other coastal communities that have already enacted similar laws. Now, city staff have found overwhelming support, obviously from our audience here too, and residents and businesses for this ban. The businesses will have until January 1st, 2020 to discontinue their use of those plastics. Number two, the Post and Courier reported, I think there's a trend here, that the Trump administration has approved seismic testing off the Atlantic coast to explore potential natural gas and oil reserves that include, I had a feeling that was gonna happen. We're not prompting them, they're just doing it. That includes off South Carolina's coast. This is an initial step toward leasing federal offshore waters for oil companies. Now, the testing would involve loud seismic air guns considered harmful to marine mammals and other sea life. Number three, some statehouse intrigue for y'all listening and paying attention. We got that coming up in January. In a major shakeup, House Speaker Jay Lucas reassigned House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Brian White. The chairman and committee helps craft the annual budget. They direct how billions of dollars in tax revenue is spent and also deals with business-related legislation. So it's a very important committee that we all watch. Now, White became head of the committee in 2011 under Speaker Bobby Harrell, but he has since kind of rubbed colleagues the wrong way and Speaker Jay Lucas, so primarily for making a lot of decisions without consulting them. So a lot of ins and outs at the State House that we're going to be watching next year. Instead, Sumter Republican Merle Smith was elected the new chairman. And number four, we have a Nikki Haley update. You guys might know who she is. She's the former governor of South Carolina, and she's the outgoing U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. But she's not coming straight back to South Carolina when she leaves that job at the end of the year, according to the Post and Courier. She plans on staying in New York, where her son, Nalen, attends high school. And Haley and her husband, Michael, recently sold their Lexington home. She's expected to write a second book soon, and though she's reportedly not doing it yet. Her future plans have not been announced, but we know she's not running for 2020. She said so when she was in the Oval Office with President Trump. But we just seriously buried the lead right there, just like a tourist wading through flooded Market Street because it rained 1 inch. Do not go in that water, folks. That is not good water to wade through. So let's kick off our main discussion. Now, it's been a long, wild, mostly fun, and definitely surprising 2018. We have a lot of ground to cover, so we brought in the pros. We have the reporters from the Post and Courier with us. We have Jamie Lovegrove with the PNC's Columbia Bureau. We got Thad Moore, who was on PNC's business desk, and now he's on special projects. He has one star up there already. And we have a first-timer, Caitlin Bird, who's also on the politics team and authors the Daily Palmetto Politics newsletter.
Thanks for the shout-out.
And that's that newsletter is a great source. You guys should subscribe to it. And you should also subscribe to the Post and Courier,
Absolutely. My
former newspaper.
Nope.
Local news does not happen without people like you guys and without their supportive subscribers and readers like you. So,
true that.
Welcome to everyone here. Thank you guys for being here.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. A lot of reading. So, Caitlin, we're going to start with you. We're talking about the 1st Congressional District. You guys might have heard of it. I think there's someone in the audience that actually was pretty heavily involved in that race. Caitlin, you covered this race extensively. Jamie covered it, too. It was a roller coaster from the primary up into election night. It was a very late election night. Just kind of give us, we got a Democrat for the 1st Congressional District for the first time.
First time in almost 20, 30 years.
So, tell us again, like, what made that such a nail-biter of a race from... You know, Katie Arrington, the Republican who upset Mark Sanford in the primary, to a little bit of election night. I know we have about five topics. I want to let you guys know we have five top stories, so we're going to try and do these pretty quick, 5 minutes about each. But as you know, it's a lot to cover. So, Caitlin, just kind of break down the 1st Congressional District race for us.
Yeah, well, first, I just want to say that it was a complete honor to cover this race for Charleston. It was my first time covering a congressional race, and I literally think that my editor thought, oh, this will be a cakewalk. Mark Sanford will win. Everything will go according to plan, because as someone told me after the election, it was a GOP operative, he said that Mark Sanford is the Energizer Bunny of South Carolina politics. He just keeps going and going and going and going. But
Where's
he did not.
Yeah.
Now no one knows where he's going. Mark doesn't seem to want to publicly say where he's going either. So anyway, that being said, it was a nail-biter from start to finish, to use your words. No one really saw this coming. Anyone who says that they saw Katie Arrington beating Mark Sanford, I don't believe you. Unless they were on the ground working with her, because her campaign worked their butts off in the primary. There's no doubt about that.
Defeated him by 4 points in the primary.
4 points at 366 votes.
Every vote counts.
Every vote does count, and especially in primaries.
Barely avoided a runoff. Yeah.
Barely.
Yeah.
That's correct. And it happened with an assist from the President of the United States, who tweeted on primary election day in favor of her, but also largely against Mark Sanford. It was kind of a go Katie, get out of town, Mark kind of a tweet. And people talk about the tweet a lot, but what they forget is that it was a rainy primary election day. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people might have been more inclined to stay at home. And instead, the Arrington campaign says that they really felt that that last minute tweet put them over the top. Mm-hmm. Because they also put out a robocall, reminding people and reading the tweet verbatim. You can actually hear staffers and people in the background if you go back and listen to that robocall. So they really did make that on the fly. And they said that the president did not give them any heads up. And if you listen to that robocall, it seems pretty clear that it was not necessarily polished. And I don't mean that in any negative way. I just mean they got it and they ran with it.
So,
and then she
won. She won.
So it was crazy.
And then, you know, and then fast forward a couple weeks after that, and she got a
terrible car accident.
Yeah.
She was critically injured. People didn't know whether or not she was even going to continue in the race. A lot of people were speculating whether or not Mark Sanford would come in to replace her. That's how dramatic this race was. People thought, oh, is the person who lost going to come back? And no, she was determined. Mm-hmm. And if you met Katie and talked to her, she is steadfast in her goals. She was writing the word C-A-M-P on a notepad when she was still in the hospital and talking with Senator Tim Scott. And it was the beginning of the word campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So she was committed. She wanted to be the GOP nominee. She had won being the GOP nominee, barely, but she won it. And people thought, and operatives thought, that surely she has it now. She has sympathy. You know, Katie is someone who might rubs some people the wrong way because she's very vocal, she's very strong, and she may be small, but she be fierce. Mm-hmm. That's what she says a lot.
Yeah. We saw her in the State House. I mean, she
you guys
she
know.
Has that, yeah.
You guys know. She is the bulldog. So a lot of people thought, oh, she's got it. It's a shoo-in. And then again, you know, this was really the assumption-shattering race of South Carolina, mm-hmm. and one of two major upsets in the country. Nate Silver at 538, they cover elections nationally. They said that this was one of the two biggest upsets in the entire country.
Awesome. Great take on the first congressional district. Jamie, let's jump into the governor's race. You and I cover this. We rode the bus, the McMaster bus, the James Smith RV, but let's go back to the... There's a lot of back and forth on that.
It was the leave no one behind RV and the SC winning bus.
But it started off with three Democrats, five Republicans in the primary. James Smith, he's a Democrat, from Richland County. He won it outright pretty easily. Governor McMaster got forced into a runoff with upstate businessman John Warren, which was a little bit of a surprise. He was a latecomer to that race, and he really just jumped in there. Tell us the surprises of that, and then we'll get right into like what happened on Election Day, but why that was such a stunning situation at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, well, you know, John Warren's entrance into that race really changed the dynamic so remarkably, you know, just a few months before the primary. It really seemed for 10 months until he entered that race, like the dynamic was pretty clear, which was Catherine Templeton versus Senator McMaster. Kevin Bryant, the lieutenant governor, had gotten into the race and was trying to get some of the sort of very socially conservative voters, and Yancey McGill was a figure.
Going down the PD vote.
Race. Yeah, got Williamsburg County. He really changed everything. He jumped in. He has a lot of resources. He spent $3 million of his own money on that race. And, you know, he got a lot of people talking, of course, about what his political future might be. He was speculated often in the aftermath of that race as a potential primary challenger to Lindsey Graham in 2020, partly because he talked about Lindsey Graham so much during the primary. Mm-hmm. I think now that's probably a lot less likely given Graham's increased popularity among conservatives, which we will get to. But getting back to the governor's race, I think... You know, political folks will always say that primaries can, you know, competitive primaries can in some ways strengthen the eventual winner. It battle tests you. It makes you refine your message.
Or for James Smith or those two other Democrats.
Publicity.
You know.
Yeah. So for both of them, the fact that they had competitive primaries, I think, did set them up to run a very competitive general election.
We did see President Donald Trump come in, Vice President Mike Pence come in that weekend before, those days before the eve of, come in and really kind of get that last-minute push.
Governor,
because McMaster was so close, I mean, do we think that really helped push him over, or at least get those people that were maybe on the fence with him? Because a lot of those voters, I mean, different voters for McMaster, different voters for John Warren.
Sure. It was a very regional race at the end of the day. John Warren really creamed him in the upstate, where he is from Greenville, and the governor did pretty well around the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in this day and age, in the Republican Party and Republican primary, an endorsement from President Trump is generally helpful. How much? I don't know. I talked to plenty of voters who said it didn't really factor into their mind, but it certainly doesn't hurt at this point. Yeah.
And then on election night, we did see, when we saw Haley's second election night, the AP called that race 7:01, a minute after polls closed. This time it was a little bit later. We were waiting there at McMaster's watch party. Oh, with Meg Kinnard. Meg, if you're listening, hello. But they didn't call that race the AP. We were waiting. You know, we all just wait till the AP calls races. And so was the campaign, but that was called at 9:30. Yep. He won by 8 points when it was all said and done. So what did the Democrats take away from this? Because James Smith, I mean, that wasn't a blowout per se, but it was a little bit closer. But it wasn't 4 points like it was in 2010 with Vincent Shaheen and Nikki Haley.
Yeah, well, you know, as you say, it's kind of right in between the 2010 and the 2014 results in terms of how encouraging it'll be for South Carolina Democrats. I mean, look, you know, I talked to a lot of folks in the days after that race. There are plenty of technical things you can point to. Mm-hmm. A big contrast between Joe Cunningham, who succeeded down here, and James Smith was that a lot of people pointed to was that one of them had a lot more discipline in fundraising early in the race than the other. And when you're early on, you know, it's not a fun thing to do, to be spending hours and hours in call time. It's never fun asking people for money. But when you get down to the home stretch, you're going to need that money to be blitzing the airwaves and to be getting your name ID out, you know, particularly for two candidates who were not very well known. I mean, both Joe and James were not very well known before this race. Even though James has been in state politics 22 years, he was only really known in the Columbia area. You know, I think there will be continued discussions over the next 4 years before 2022, A, about whether or not South Carolina Democrats need to nominate at least a black running mate or a black candidate.
Well, Margaret E. Wilson.
It's a huge part of the Democratic voting block. I was with James Smith in, you know, some of the more heavily African-American areas of the state, and there didn't seem to be a huge amount of enthusiasm. And there are going to be some lawmakers and operatives who say that that's part of the direction they need to go in and start trying to energize the base as opposed to trying to win over moderate Republicans who may be hard to get. But look, I mean, it's been the same conversation for decades, right? How Democrats can win back the state.
Yeah, so a lot to digest from that. And another story to digest is the SCNG boondoggle, the number three story of the year, which is, I don't want to call the never-ending story that. Is that a correct assumption to call it that?
It feels like a never-ending story, yeah.
Because that started, last summer when we first heard news of the two reactors being built, the nuclear reactors at VC Summer, between SCNG and Santee Cooper, went belly up, folded, $9 billion, poof, and we're still paying for it, we're still dealing with it. But Thad, tell me a little bit about this past year and what we've seen. You know, we saw a lot of noise coming out of the State House. We did see some action towards the very end there on them lowering bills and such like that. But just give us a rundown about what we saw happening with SCNG this year, and we'll talk about what's happening in the future.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we're kind of where we started-ish, except we're closer to the finish. Mm. We're not at it.
Very encouraging.
Still like a week to go, at least. But yeah, basically what we saw was we saw sort of a deeper understanding of what exactly went wrong with the nuclear reactors. And really more to the point, we saw more about what the utilities knew about what was going wrong before it went wrong.
That just weren't made public.
Or at least weren't, you know, in your face public, right? Yeah. That's something for lawyers and the FBI to decide. But yeah, so basically what we saw was the legislature did take action over the summer after months and months of debate. We saw them cut SCE&G's bills by 15%, which is like most of what people were paying for the reactors. Mm-hmm. Not quite all of it, but closer than 18%.
And then the feds backed that up too.
Yeah, yeah. So it was challenged in court, and the court basically said, "Yeah, no, the legislature can cut rates if they want." Mm-hmm. That decision basically belongs to the Public Service Commission. The legislature's rate cut only lasts through basically the end of this month. And so, with the Public Service Commission, the utility regulators for the state, what they're deciding is where do we want to go long term. Mm-hmm. And what it looks like is basically people are going to pay probably billions. But fewer billions than it would have been.
Okay, so, tell me more.
Right, not out of the woods. That decision is going to come down in about a week, basically, next Friday.
And yeah, I hope everyone doesn't have big plans for Friday afternoon, because there's going to be very thrilling news out of the Public Service Commission.
Yeah, I know everyone's waiting for Public Service Commission.
I know Andy Brown.
Here.
I mean, I don't think he's going to sleep till then. Maybe.
No, I don't think so.
Probably not.
Probably has like six different stories ready to go.
Right.
But yeah, tell us about the Public Service Commission hearings, because it was 3 weeks of just riveting testimony, from what I understand.
Oh, so
Andy Brown. Andy Brown talked about it on our podcast last week when you're hearing this, but. Really went into the detail about it, but what was the purpose of those hearings? What were they looking for? And then also, we can talk about the Dominion merger too, but sure. What were they hearing that testimony for?
Yeah, so basically the point of the Public Service Commission hearing, I mean, we've had a lot of reporting. Our newspaper certainly has done a
ton. You guys have been leading the charge on it. Let's not
get around
the bush.
We try to, I mean, we've been trying to sort of understand, like, what did they know? And what are federal investigators going to be looking at, right? We don't exactly know, but we know that they're looking still, so that's interesting. But basically the Public Service Commission, their job is to sort of find the facts, basically figure out what was known, when was it known, and was it sort of conveyed appropriately. And obviously there are a lot of opinions, according to my voicemail, about that fact, and I think in the room too. But basically then they're going to take that information and sort of decide, where do we set rates?
Mm-hmm. Going forward.
And there are all kinds of minutiae that they got into over 3 weeks of the Public Service Commission about all kinds of boring stuff about rate making that you guys don't need to know about.
Yeah.
But basically, it's how much do people pay?
Yeah.
And sort of where does the line of culpability fall?
And dealing with that, there's also talk about how they're going to decide on the $14.6 billion merger. with Dominion Energy from Virginia. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be decided on the 14th as well? Do we understand?
As far as we know, yeah. So basically, it's sort of one gigantic decision to make, mm-hmm. which is, do we sell SCE&G to Dominion? And then if we do, how much do they kind of eat? Basically, Dominion came in, now it feels like 18 years ago, but it was actually January when it was snowing down here. Believe that.
Yeah.
and basically, they sort of pumped a bunch of money into this deal, mm-hmm. in essence, to bring down what ratepayers will ultimately pay, which is how we got from like $7 billion to like $2.3 billion, mm-hmm. which is, you know, billions of dollars, but it's fewer billions of dollars, so that's something.
And the settlement, too, really quickly. I know we're, like, really, I know everyone, like, my eyes glaze over, too, when we talk about SCNG, but it affects a lot of us. I mean, I'm a ratepayer as well. I mean, I'm awake right now.
Say?
No, I mean, I'm just, but then there's all these moving parts that we're talking about, the PSC, now the settlement with the judge. Just break that down in terms of how that is affecting that ruling from the PSC as well.
Right, so there are like 18 million moving parts on the SCNG saga.
Lots of lawyers making a lot of money.
That was the name of our episode
so
last week,
Billable Hours.
Billable Hours.
It's so real. People being billed to read the newspaper. So anyway.
There's a plug.
Please subscribe.
It's the only one you get.
So anyway, a group of SCNG ratepayers were like, oh, we're suing you, SCNG. Like, this is outrageous.
Well, yeah, we're pissed off.
And that lawsuit is probably settled. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's settled as long as the Public Service Commission approves the Dominion deal, which brings the total cost down to $2.3 billion. Mm-hmm. On top of the sort of rate cut or the reductions that Dominion's agreed to, they're going to chip in like $115 million and then a bunch of real estate, like some stuff downtown. Mm-hmm. It's unclear how much of that is going to go to the lawyers for their billable hours, but the rest will go to ratepayers for some amount of a refund.
Gotcha. So again, TBD. Like we said last week, a very happy Christmas if you are a lawyer, Esquire. You, Merry Christmas. Jamie, I want to switch over to the State House probe, our number four story of the year. In June, long-serving Richland County Republican Senator John Corson pleaded guilty to one count of willful misconduct in office. He became the fourth Republican lawmaker at the time to plead guilty. Just tell us about the ramifications on that. I mean, we've heard calls for ethics reforms to be a top priority next year as well. But what would have been
every
like
year.
Every year? Is this going to be the year? Maybe
the
we'll
annual
talk about education.
Ethics reform year.
But are we gonna maybe see any of that? And also, just what were the immediate effects, at least for his District 20 seat?
I don't know. Well, Gary Clary certainly hopes so. Mm-hmm. Judge Gary Clary,
who's a listener. Hey, Gary.
Who is a representative from up in Clemson, big ethics reform proponent. You know, it is the thing we talk about every single year going into the State House session, particularly since the State House probe started several years ago. Mm-hmm. This was a very long-running investigation that seems to now finally be tapering off. We do still have one trial with Tracy Edge, mm-hmm. theoretically, coming up. Jim Harrison is trying to stay out of prison while he appeals. He was granted
that.
He
was found guilty in October.
But politically, a lot of candidates tried over the last several years, not just this cycle, but this cycle as well, tried to run on ethics as their major talking point. You know,
cleaning up Columbia. We saw that in the gubernatorial race. A lot of people
tried to attack
McMaster's
connections. We saw it in the gubernatorial race during the GOP primary and during the general election. Mm-hmm. It was a huge part of the attorney general's race because Alan Wilson, the attorney general, was a client of Richard Quinn, who was, you know, the kingmaker that was involved in all of this. Mm-hmm. And Constance Nostopula, the Democratic nominee for attorney general, hit that every single day for the entire campaign, and it didn't work. You know, I think it's an issue that everyone cares about in the abstract. Nobody wants corruption, but people kind of get lost in some of the details there. A lot of people don't know the names of some of these lawmakers. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still don't know who the Quinns are. You know, I mean, sometimes political candidates will throw out the Quinns.
Yeah. Even Hugh Leatherman. I mean, we saw that during the
right,
Republicans.
Right, Hugh Leatherman.
You
like,
really
a lot of voters don't know who Hugh Leatherman is. He's very, very, very powerful. You should arguably know him more than you know the governor. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge political boon for candidates who try to use that. So the verdict in the Jim Harrison trial and the fact that he has been sentenced to 18 months in prison, he is appealing that. But he was the first indicted lawmaker to take his case to trial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Andy Brown, one of our colleagues, was covering that trial. And every day he was tweeting stuff from the trial and he was covering days from the trial. It was just one of the most one-sided trials I've ever seen in my entire life. And it made you realize why none of these other indicted lawmakers had taken their case to trial. They'd all pleaded guilty. Harrison was defiant. He really wanted to prove his case. And Special Prosecutor David Pascoe really came with the goods. And it was pretty clear that he had broken the law in multiple ways. He was convicted on multiple counts. And so, you know, I do think whether or not ethics reform becomes a major movement in the legislature, which is always, always very hard to do, I can certainly tell you that lawmakers are much more on guard with what they are doing now. You know, this has been a kind of a cyclical thing in South Carolina. Lost trust in the 90s, put lawmakers on guard, and then over the ensuing two decades, they kind of got more and more relaxed, and then they got prosecuted again. But they are aware now of the fact that people are paying attention. They are generally filing their disclosures in more complete fashion.
Amendment.
So if that may be one positive thing that comes out.
wrapping up our top five, and we're talking about movement in the legislature, the Post and Courier's Minimally Adequate series, which if you have not read it yet, is just remarkable. Yeah. Team of reporters worked on that.
Thank you.
Thad, you were one of them. We have, I think Paul Bowers is still in the audience. He's here. He was one of the reporters, too. Just really looked at the challenges of education in South Carolina from basically Civil War era till now, and just how everything is affected by, you know, the years ahead of it and the years in front of it, essentially, and low funding and all those wonderful things. There's not just one thing that affects education in South Carolina. Some people like
not
to think it's certain things, but it's definitely a multitude of issues. But Thad, tell us about this series. You guys spent months on it. What prompted it, and what did you guys discover, essentially?
Sure. I mean, it's a lot to unpack. But basically what prompted it is that South Carolina, for pretty much as long as anyone can remember, has been at the bottom or close to the bottom of pretty much whatever academic measure or ranking that you look at for education. And we kind of asked, like, well, why is that?
Yeah. should that be the case?
Right.
Just to jump in, it kind of goes back to the Till Death Do Us Part series, the Pulitzer Prize winning series by the Post and Courier, when we were consistently ranked at the top for criminal domestic violence, women die at the hands of men, and it was just like, oh, well, we're always at the top, that's always going to be the case. It's like, why don't we look at why we're at the top? And that's what you guys do with education, essentially.
Yeah, the idea was to not take it for granted and kind of see, like, why is it this way? And the reasons are many, and I hope you read the series. You can read it for free. I hope you subscribe after that, but like you can read it for free at postandcareer.com/minimallyadequate.
There we go.
Got to get that plug in. But the short of it is that we have a pretty bleak history and a really dark history here around education, and we really haven't reckoned with it. And it sort of echoes through where we are today as a state. And the sort of impact of that is that we have, you know, huge swaths of the state where you have more people graduating from high school unprepared for most jobs than prepared for most jobs, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And we are in a state that is trying to sort of lift itself to become sort of this like manufacturing renaissance and sort of a more advanced state. It's a state that had depended on, you know, sort of low wage, low skill labor like textile mills, and clearly that has gone, you know, decades ago. And basically, the sort of rub is that we really need to improve our schools to keep up. And that sort of became the premise of the project, and sort of tying our history to our future, which is a link that I think sort of everyone understands, but we sort of wanted to lay it out there.
Yeah, they're all interrelated, of course. And, you know, we talked about the effect that business has had on this situation. You know, they're always major proponents and really kind of spearheading some of these changes. But I mean, are they worried, or did you hear from businesses? Like I said, you were on the business desk for a while, you kind of know what's going on, you get the pulse there, but are they worried when they look at, you know, these graduation rates and these test scores? I mean, are they worried that, hey, is there actually the workforce here that you told me I could build this plant here, and then all of a sudden, you know, these guys can't test on level here? So what's the worry there, and are we headed toward a crisis, or are we about to mitigate a crisis?
Well, that's a good question.
Should I ask the State House that question?
That's really a question for the State House on the mitigation. But yeah, so basically, it seems like it should have a simple answer, but it doesn't quite. You hear businesses all the time, especially down in Charleston and up in Greenville, you know, places that have a really sort of big and expanding manufacturing presence say that we have like a crisis here of skilled workers, mm-hmm. Which everyone sort of attributes to like low unemployment and, you know, it's a really robust economy, so there's a lot of competition for workers. But there's also this sort of this gap between the students that were graduating and the skills that are needed. And just basic things like algebra. Like, yeah. You have to be able to do algebra to have a manufacturing job. Like, that's sort of the reality of the world we live in now.
And it's interesting because you guys obviously were putting that all out there. And again, it was just a very straightforward series, just saying, hey, here is the situation in South Carolina. Someone do something with it. Because you're a newspaper, you guys don't, I mean, you're not in office, but you put it out there so people can make informed decisions. And we did see Speaker Jay Lucas again mention it this week. He said, quote, without significant reforms, our students won't have a future. It's time to change the educational model in South Carolina, and I look forward to working with each of you to do that this legislative session. So that's a pretty big commitment right there from the speaker. We've seen him be very vocal and very passionate with the gas tax increase, and they pushed that through very, very hard. Obviously, the House is different than the Senate, but it sounds like that's going to become a major priority for lawmakers next session.
Yeah, that's certainly the hope. I mean, we've definitely heard more enthusiasm about this from the governor's office. We've heard that education is going to be a centerpiece of his State of the State address next month. We've heard Jay
Lucas.
Watch
on ETV. There's a plug.
Nice plug. Plug. We heard Jay Lucas say that it's time to face it's the time to face reality in education in South Carolina. So certainly it seems like there's a lot of interest there. Obviously dealing with education is incredibly complicated and there's a lot that goes into it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, easier said than done. I think Gilda Cobb Hunter, a longtime Democrat in the House, who's now the number two person on the budget committee in the House, she said, I'd like to see the result more than I'd like to hear the words. It's essentially what she said.
I mean, people have always talked, similar to ethics reform, people always talk a big game and then nothing ever actually happens. So it will be interesting to see whether this session turns out differently.
Well, that was a lot to cover and I hope everyone paid attention because there is going to be a quiz. Check under your seats. There's quizzes. I'm just kidding. But I mean, again, that's why we love this podcast so much because we have the reporters on that cover these stories in and out. So you can get an idea about what actually went on without the spin, without any of the other things intruding on that. So we had Thad Moore, Kalen Bird, and Jamie Lovegrove, renaming people from the Post and Courier. Thank you guys very much for your insight.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you to this crowd.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. This is named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here live with us right now in Brewery with some more great state trivia? And as you know, if you listen, I'm not very great on the state trivia because I did not grow up here. But I'm a transplant, been here for 7 years, and my parents are moving here too. So. That being said, I'm just going to throw it out there. Russ has some great trivia for us. He's going to ask the question. We're going to poll the audience just so I can hedge my bet. Don't shout out the answer, even though you're probably really passionate because you're a South Carolinian. That's great. But Russ, let's hear what you got.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be
Welcome
here.
Welcome, Russ.
Glad to be here in Charleston.
And Micah Kasky in the house.
Wait,
wow.
Can we give a quick shout out?
And we only give shout outs for people that are here, so I'm giving a shout out to my dad and Colleen, and then, of course, State Rep Micah Kasky in the house.
And State Gemstone Micah Kasky.
And he's also State Gemstone. Hey, you got to listen to know.
That's a very inside joke for two high compliments on the lead.
Okay,
lead
Russ.
Heads.
Okay.
What do we got? This is low country focus like we do, so.
Yeah,
here we go.
Go ahead and admit, we've got some lame questions tonight. They're just not that good. And
Mike, I swear to God.
Yeah, let me first of all, before we've glad to be here, see a lot of friends here of South Carolina Public Radio and ETV. Thank you very much for being here. Let me also, thank you. Okay, I didn't realize there were going to be as many Post and Courier folks here. They're here. So there are going to be some ground rules. Brian Hicks is not eligible to answer any of these questions. And we did this a couple of weeks ago in Greenville, and Jamie Lovegrove was Google searching it as we asked the question.
That is a lie.
So
that is a lie.
That's not allowed.
That's how he plays.
And again, these are pretty simple ones tonight. All right. We all know the first Europeans that came to South Carolina came to Charlestown. They had their settlement on the Ashley River in 1670. But in 10 years, they moved a little bit They actually went to the lower end of the Charleston Peninsula to have their settlement. They even had a gate and a fence roughly where Broad and Meeting Street is today.
Just one gate?
Yeah. They call that the...
I haven't had people know what I'm talking about.
They call that the central gate. I think my cousin who lives below Broad said they would welcome the reintroduction of that gate and fence at Broad and Meeting Street. But anyway, but our question
is... South of Broad joke.
Our question
my
is...
My monocle just broke, Russ. I'm sorry.
What did the settlement on the peninsula, on the lower part of the peninsula, what was it called? We talk about Charlestown Landing in a historic standpoint, but what was it called? And the your options are A, Battery Island, B, Oyster Point, C, Hadrill's Point, D, Albemarle Point.
What does everyone think?
I think I've seen Albemarle.
Okay, A, Battery, raise your hands.
Raise
A,
your hands,
Battery Island.
I think it's got to be Battery Island.
B, Oyster Point. Oyster Point.
I like Oyster Point.
I like oysters, but I'm not.
C, Hadrill's Point. D, Albemarle Point.
I'm doing
Point.
D. I'm doing
D.
D.
B. D on this one.
Answer is B, Oyster Point.
Yeah! One South Carolinian got it right.
You guys need to know your Charleston history now. Come on, now. I know.
Where's my blood's not blue enough to know that
if Skyler was still here. I believe he snuck out there.
Well, Russ, thank you as always for excitement, disappointment, and information.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org, listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio, and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. And follow us on Instagram at SCLEDEPOD, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE at SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. And thank you again, Munkle Brewing Company, for having us. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media strategist. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was produced and recorded at Munkle Brewing Company in Charleston, South Carolina, on December 6, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Grandpa got run over by a reindeer and has massive internal bleeding. He's not looking good.